This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Studies estimate that there are between 1,000 and 1,500 murder-suicides in the United States each year. That's less than 3% of suicides. While it's statistically a rare event, it happens with enough regularity to deserve special attention because this is a special kind of tragedy. We saw it this weekend in Kerrville with City Councilmember Gary Stork and his wife Peggy. Both were found dead in a suspected murder-suicide. Here's Gary Stork talking about his life at a City Council debate organized by the League of Women Voters.
Hi, my name is Gary Stork. I am currently sitting on City Council. I appreciate and know what an honor it is to serve you for the last 2 years, and I'm asking for another 2 years to serve you. I've been married to my best friend for 36 years next week, and we have two beautiful adult children who live out of state. They're suffering for that. And finished my college, my undergraduate degree from Austin Graduate School of Theology. I got my MBA from Oklahoma Christian University, where I learned how to do case studies and how to build business plans and visions and mission statements and stuff like that. So I am excited about my education and how it's helped me to make good decisions for Kerrville.
The Kerrville police are not sharing much information with the public about this case. We do not know who the suspected aggressor was, but we do know that Gary Stork was being investigated for indecency with the child, and that case was due to go before a grand jury this week. And we do know that in 93% of domestic murder-suicide cases, men are the aggressors and women are the victims. So what to do about this? How can we protect women from murder-suicides? Is there a general attitude about these events that covers them up, a conspiracy of silence in society that makes the woman a victim again? We want to talk about this. Call in 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Have you been touched by a murder-suicide, by a family member or someone that you know? What do you think needs to be done about this? Do you think there is a conspiracy of silence in society about these things? That we need to talk about them to figure out how they can be prevented. Give us also email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet us at @tprsource. We're joined this half hour in the studio by Miriam Elizondo. She's the executive director of the Rape Crisis Center of South Texas, and Marta Peliz, executive director of the Family Violence Prevention Services, and welcome to The Source, both of y'all.
Thank you. Thank you.
Marta, let me ask you, over at the Family Violence Prevention Services, how frequently does a murder-suicide become part of what you do?
Amidst all of the cases that we see related to domestic violence, it is, fortunately, if I can say that, a rare occurrence. And I say rare because there is a lot that needs to be investigated around those events that sometimes, whether it is a murder-suicide or not, is not clearly determined.
But you have had to deal with them.
Absolutely. And at a more personal or agency level, we have we chair a death analysis review team that takes a look at all of those deaths that have not been investigated and thoroughly determined what was the cause of death. And some of them are murder-suicides. And we find that in analyzing the gaps in services and understanding some of the personal circumstances, we determined that, yes, there was, in most likelihood, there was a murder-suicide situation.
A murder-suicide situation that could have been predicted, was predictable?
Predictable and, sadly enough, preventable, yes.
And Miriam Elizondo at the Rape Crisis Center of South Texas, you're dealing mainly with the women as they come in, and do they talk about that this is their fear?
Yes, and actually at the Rape Crisis Center, we're seeing an increase in male survivors, male adult survivors as well. So we are working with both male, female, youth, children, and adults. We have seen an increase in those who are indicating that they are suicidal. So we're working more with the survivor of of victimization. And so I can tell you that in my 12 years at the Rape Crisis Center and a clinician by trade, we have had three, for sure, completed suicides in my time there. And as a clinical director, if you ask around, that's not very common for you to even experience one. And it is definitely, from a clinical standpoint, our number one fear to lose a client in that way. But we have seen an increase coming in through our hotline, coming in through our counseling clients of those who are expressing that suicide or even homicide ideation. And so that's how we work and try to assess and disseminate those very charged feelings.
So with clients that you have, and they may be in a domestic situation, mm-hmm. and they have an aggressor in the household, and they may come to you and say, I am worried sick that I'm going to be a victim of a murder-suicide.
Yes, and unfortunately that does happen. Many times, you know, obviously our focus is to keep that individual safe, and you know we will try to find safety and working very closely with Martha and her shelter and sending them there for safety. The reality is, though, sometimes they can't leave. The perpetrators will have their children or will have something that causes the women or the spouse, the victim spouse, to return. And so, unfortunately, we have to go into safety planning of, you know, how do you keep safe in such a dangerous situation and decrease risk as much as possible. That is not what we want to do, but unfortunately, some of our victims have to return home for one reason or another.
Do you think that there are societal pressures on women to be very reluctant to leave a man, even though he is showing signs of being able to do something like this, that we just the stand by your man attitude and they're almost psychologically shackled to this household and they can't leave, Martha?
Well, there is something that is known as the generational effect. When you have been raised in a home where abuse was the normal, and your parents were raised in a home where abuse was the normal, it stands to reason that through that process of socialization, you will become either a perpetrator or a victim. It is by destiny, if you will, by generational destiny. So when those two young children, boy and girl, are beginning to date and to relate to romantically and intimately to other people, they know exactly what adjustments they need to make because they already have learned certain skills that predetermine what role it is that they're going to play. So in that sense, yes, women are socialized to be victims in general terms, and men, again, 90%+ of domestic violence is perpetrated by men onto women, and little boys are socialized into becoming the perpetrators. The other thing is that I think that being the emotional pillars in our homes is part of our nature. So that also predetermines a woman victim to say something like, I can change him.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to continue our discussion talking about the murder-suicide and trying to end this conspiracy of silence in society about it. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the phenomenon of murder-suicides. It can involve a number of different interrelated factors, biological, social. Murder-suicides are most oftenly perpetrated by men, and their underlying motives and actions are linked to masculinity in a different ways, diversity of ways. There's things like domestic desperation, workplace justice, school retaliation. That's in broad terms about murder, suicide. But when we talk about in the home, the domestic desperation is one that really triggers and brings about the men's self-perception of failing to deal with being a man in a masculine kind of way. And we see breakdowns in this term. And 93% of murder-suicides in the home are perpetrated by men and women are the victims. And what can we do about this? What are the warning signs? How do we raise awareness about this? Call in 210-614-8980. If you've got a question or a comment, if you've seen something like this in your life, you want to hear your story, if you're worried that this might be happening to you, could happen to someone you love, give us a call, 210-614-8980. With me in the studio, Miriam Elizondo, Executive Director of the Rape Crisis Center of South Texas, and Martha Palaez. She is the Executive Director of the Family Violence Prevention Services here in San Antonio as well. Phone line is 210-614-8980. So, Miriam, when we talk about the trigger of the failure of masculinity causing murder, suicides, just this desperation in the home, there are all sorts of warning signs that can lead to this. This has not happened from one day to the next. The pulling out of the weapon and beginning this assault, that's there's a long road that leads to that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the reality is that when you see one type of violence, you typically see another. So, you know, when you have perhaps a sexual violence, you may see that connected to maybe a domestic violence or maybe some psychological abuse and violence. And so there could be some warning signs. But still, you know, I think that the going back and really realizing what the problem is really focusing and determining that we are socializing, you know, our boys and our girls, we're still, though it's 2016, we're still objectifying women, and we're still putting boys into these categories to deal with things like a man, to not be a Nancy about things. And even that terminology, it wasn't too long ago that we went to a department store, a very popular department store, and there was a shirt that had a stick figure of a boy and a girl, and one said problem, and it looked like the girl was arguing, and then problem solved was the next block, and it was the boy throwing the girl out of the box. And this was a child size t-shirt at a popular department store. These are things that are still happening, and we have to decide what are those messages that our boys, our young men are getting on a day-to-day basis that tells them how they are supposed to deal with complicated issues. It's typically not going and finding counseling or being vulnerable about maybe what their upbringing is or maybe what their culture is saying to do. It's certainly not that. It's really dealing with the problem, and that oftentimes leads to violence.
Martha, over at the Family Violence Prevention Services, have you had to deal with the aftermath of these events with children that need some sort of counseling?
Absolutely. Let it be said that we changed the name of our one residential program from Better Women's to Better Women and Children's Shelter. We did that maybe 9 years ago just to give life to the notion, if nothing else in the name, to the notion and the understanding that the majority of the victims of abuse and violence are children, are not women.
Right.
It's children. So the impact that this has on a community is futuristic. Something needs to be done. It's related to so many other areas of social deficiency. It's related to child abuse directly, because that's what it is. It is related to gang membership. It is related to human trafficking. I quite frequently...
But the case we just saw recently, it's still a suspected murder-suicide in Kerrville, but this was an upper-class family, you know, highly respected, not gang members, you know.
Domestic violence does not respect. It is everywhere. The socioeconomic continuum is represented across at the shelter, non-residential services. Law enforcement can tell you that. Just as they go to a home of lesser value, they go to a mansion to deal with domestic violence. In fact, in our very own programs, we see some demographical difference between the person that typically comes to the shelter and the one that makes a phone call on Friday after hours because she wants a very special treatment, a higher degree of, let's say, confidentiality and not having to come to the building, et cetera, or has just questions that she wants to be dealt with over the phone. It's a very complex phenomenon in terms of the insecurities that permeate the perpetrators. That needs to be explored as well. Domestic violence is progressive. So I want the listeners to understand that this case that we are talking about, the case in Kerrville, most likely did not begin and end, unfortunately, with someone putting a gun to the other's head. It is a trajectory, is a path. It begins with very subtle controlling behaviors, and it ends up with the ultimate act of control, which is killing the other one.
Well, what about the gun purchase, the gun ownership, the gun in the house? What does that do to the likelihood that that weapon will be used in the house against someone that, you know, that lives there, the woman? You know, is that something that people think about, Miriam?
Well, that's a great question, and I don't know if I have the right answer, but I can tell you that there are many gun owners that have no violent tendencies. And I think that there are many violent individuals who would like to purchase a gun. And so I don't think that one is indicative of another. But I do believe, and go back to Martha, is if there are red flags already, and there, you know, if there's domestic violence in the home and then a gun is purchased, that is a significant cause for concern.
It is the difference between a dead victim of domestic violence and one that survives.
Do you think that there needs to be more concern after a murder-suicide happens and then they say, okay, and the book is closed. Okay, that's done. We don't need to investigate this. That there should be more investigation, more exploration about what led to this. How can we come up with a more accurate profile of who commits these things? You know, so Miriam, what do you think?
I do believe, you know, I'm a little bit torn because I obviously respect that there is a grieving family here, and there's also another case that's being investigated. You know, I was talking to Martha earlier that this is, you know, there's a lot of frustrating parts, but there's another part here that we haven't discussed, which is he was being investigated for indecency with a child, and now he and his family are getting empathy from the community, but what about this victim? And so, you know, so there's a concern, you know, as a victim advocate, there's a concern there. But, you know, the other concern is that there is a family that's grieving right now. They've lost both parents. They've lost their daughters or sons or aunts. And so I can truly understand the confidentiality and the privacy that goes along with that.
Yeah, but there's a societal, you know, we have to look at the facts in right. a cold way and looking at these things
right.
and a benefit from that, and we have seen there's some psychological studies that are done about murder suicides. And one thing that I read is that they're concerned and they're alarmed at the lack of information, follow-up information about what led to this event and what were some warning signs that could have been heeded. So, I mean, do you think that there needs to be more aggression towards trying to figure out what happened?
There is a very grave responsibility that the community at large and those that are investigating directly the crime to come up with answers, to allow those professionals to come in and have an opinion and study these cases so that we may learn how to assist and cover the gaps, whatever they may be. I think it's a serious responsibility of the community at large to find the reasons, to study the case, to go back and track what gaps in services. What about the friends and the families respecting their roles and respecting their confidentiality? But what are we going to sit and do nothing so we will have the same conversation until the next case is before us? I think that that is highly irresponsible.
Right. We can use data-driven investigative techniques to figure out what happens. And So it doesn't seem like it's something that has to violate people's privacy, and you know, families are mourning, but a crime was committed, and I don't know if maybe by keeping it silent and closing the book on it and saying, okay, we're not going to look at this anymore, is that a tacit way of giving permission to allow the crime to happen?
Absolutely it is. It's perpetuating whatever it was that happened there so that we will silently stand by whatever signs there may be and do nothing. So, I don't find it a responsible response on the part of the community.
Right, and I do agree with that. And so my second part of my response would be is that it is a complicated issue. Murder, suicides, victimization is a complicated issue, and there are multiple victims here. But I agree with Martha that in order for us to try to prevent this and to learn more about how the red sign, the red flags, and so forth is knowledge, is data. And so I completely agree with.
So we do know that according to some of the data that incidents of murder suicides indicate that the male perpetrators are twice as likely to be over the age of 55 and that the primary actor dies at the event, leaving scant information about the context of the underlying reasoning for the event. But, you know, typically there are things where their life has just fallen apart, mm-hmm. you know, professionally, publicly, the public humiliation, all sorts of things that are going on. Their business may have fallen out from under them, but there's also power, revenge, loyalty, profit, jealousy, and just outright terror are some of the other motives that have been described.
And again, I know that we only have pieces of information, but in general terms, maybe that ally, that partner that has helped you cover for something out of fear, out of threats.
But people have to be willing to ask for help.
Absolutely.
The woman needs to know you fear that your partner is going to act out against you and bring you into a murder-suicide, that you can ask for help.
You said something very interesting, which is at the very center of all of these relationships, and that is fear. Fear maintains the victims paralyzed and not being able to do or say anything because the threats are very real to them.
But knowing that they have a place to go and knowing that there are people, new allies out there ready to give them a hand and help them to keep them from being a victim in a fatal event like this, that's essential.
It is.
All right. Miriam Elizondo, Executive Director of the Rape Crisis Center of San Antonio. Martha Paez is the Executive Director of the Family Violence Prevention Services. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you.